On Tech News Today, the European Union says Google has to remove links when people demand it. The Apple iPad copies multitasking from Microsoft Surface. And Motorola unveils a pretty good smartphone that costs only $129 unlocked. All that and more coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Tuesday, May 13th, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free two-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. And by RingCentral, the cloud-based phone system we use here at Twit, and it just got better with the launch of Meetings, the full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral starts at under $25 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial. Buy one desk phone, get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Hell.
Tech News Today explores the big stories of the day with some of the world's best journalists. Our guest co-anchor today is Elise Hu, a reporter who covers technology for NPR's radio and online news outlets. Welcome, Elise.
Thank you, Mike. Great to be here.
Glad you're here. You're one of my favorite guest co-anchors. Not to denigrate the other guest co-anchors we have. They're all good, but you're one of my favorites, and I'm glad you're here.
Well, glad to be here. We have a lot to talk about today.
We sure do, and some great people to talk about them with. So let's get right to it. In a surprise decision, the European Union Court of Justice ruled that Google must remove or edit information or links from its search engine upon request. Greg Sterling is the founder of Sterling Market Intelligence, a senior analyst for Internet to Go, and a contributing editor for Search Engine Land, where he wrote a brilliant piece on this story. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I don't know if I would say it was brilliant, but thank you for the compliment.
I liked it quite a bit. I read about 20 of the pieces today, and yours was particularly insightful, and I enjoyed it very much and got a lot out of it. So what does this ruling mean for Google exactly?
Well, what it seems to mean is that if the data protection authority of a particular country in Europe requests specific information about an individual to be removed from its search results, that information has to be removed.
How does this actually practically play out, though? Because I just got off the phone with the Google public policy folks, and they said that this is technically going to be a mess for them to try and implement. Is that true? Will there have to be kind of an internet court for the private citizens who want information taken down to go to, or would they go straight to Google? Just how does this play out practically?
I think these are the key questions, because while the idea behind the decision that individuals should have some ability to control the information about them online is a good idea, the practical implementation is really problematic for some of the reasons that you just alluded to. The court in its materials sent out today didn't really establish a lot of guidelines. What I gather the procedure is going to be is that the individuals go to Google or go to a search engine and say, I want this or that piece of information removed. Google will then say yes or no. If it says no, then the individual will have recourse to the data protection authority, who seemingly can compel Google to make the change. And I think there's just an enormous amount of ambiguity and many gray areas here that are going to be a mess, as you suggest.
Now, how does this work across borders? Obviously, this is a European Union ruling, so I imagine that if a European person, citizen of the European Union, has a complaint, goes through the process, and can get Google to remove a link or change some information, what about the U.S. version of Google? If it's removed in Europe, do Americans and people in Asia and Africa and Latin America still see the information, but Europeans don't? And likewise, if an American or a person in China or somewhere outside of Europe posts something about a European person, can Google be compelled to remove that information?
That makes my head hurt, Mike. I don't know if I can answer those questions. I think that some of that stuff remains to be seen. My guess is that in jurisdictions outside of Europe, this would have no impact. But as you say, there are – I don't think a European – would have any ability to ask Google in the U.S. to remove data from its U.S. search results. I think that would pertain to Europe. But I think that there there are many complicated aspects to this that would that remain to be worked out. But my sort of short answer, without being a European law expert, is that it's really just going to be confined to the borders of Europe and search results that are displayed there.
And Greg, we actually have a question from a viewer that touches on some really important issues, which is his question is, if you want something taken down, shouldn't you go to where it's posted, the publisher, and not Google? And that sort of is the heart of the argument by these search engines, which is that they are intermediaries and they're not publishers. The court seems to be saying that they need to take their role far more seriously than just as a middleman. Should people just be going to publishers instead of the intermediary?
Well, this aspect of the case makes no sense. In the particular instance that gave rise to this case, a newspaper site published some information that the individual wanted removed. The newspaper refused to do so, and the European court said the newspaper doesn't have to remove the information. So applying a rule to Google or to other search engines without similarly applying the rule to the publisher doesn't make any sense, because the information will still live online at the original publisher site. And this doesn't seem to have any application to them. So I don't really understand why if the rule exists, it doesn't pertain to the publishers. But in the United States, that would be precisely the way that it would work. For example, if there was defamation or some claim like that, you would have to go to the originating publisher and resolve it with them, either informally or legally, and Google would be exempt from liability under U.S. First Amendment law and other case law. But and rules that pertain to internet specific publishing. But it's just a very problematic aspect of the decision. That's what you're supposed to do in theory, but this decision seems to make it possible for the individual to go directly to a search engine without going to the publisher first. That should be a preliminary step in any procedure.
Now, you wrote that this de facto right to be forgotten ruling is similar to California's eraser law. How are they similar?
I don't know everything about the eraser law, but my understanding of that law is that minors, those under 18, can gain the removal of embarrassing, incriminating, humiliating information that may have been published prior to their becoming an adult. So if somebody had some embarrassing pictures on Facebook or got involved in some incident that would compromise their ability to get a job, so on and so forth, that material can be removed. I don't know the precise procedure, but I think that makes a certain amount of sense, because the law treats minors as not having the same capacity to understand and consent to certain kinds of things that adults can. The distinction here, and that law may be challenged on First Amendment grounds, we'll see, but and that's in California, as you mentioned. The distinction here is that this pertains to everybody and will be primarily used by adults trying to control their reputation. My concern is really that you have, you know, business executives, sort of low-level political figures and others, professionals, who may be trying to manage public perceptions, have some shady thing in their past, negligence, corruption, some element that the public should be made aware of or entitled to know about, and they'll be trying to conceal that. That's a big gray area where I think that there's a major problem potentially.
Yeah, and in egalitarian-minded European countries like Germany and others, this seems to create a kind of problem where wealthy people, powerful people, will have the resources to go through this lengthy and probably expensive process, to throw lawyers at this whole thing, to remove not only the list of transgressions that are legitimate, which you trotted out, but also, you know, just criticism, minor things, and then argue, you know, push the envelope of exactly what's, you know, violating people's fundamental rights, is the language in the ruling. Is this going to create a sort of a class distinction between who gets privacy protection or who gets to essentially censor information about themselves, where the poorer people who don't have the time and money, anything can be said about them, and wealthy people are protected?
I think that that's a concern. I think the Europeans would probably argue this is going to be equally applicable and it's not going to be burdensome for non-wealthy individuals to pursue this. But I think you're right. As a practical matter, those with means and the ability to hire others to pursue this will be ones that succeed. And they're the ones in a position probably to, or they're the ones that are going to be concerned about managing their reputation more than, you know, a Silvio Berlusconi, for example, although a public figure, is going to be more likely to be concerned about his reputation than some resident of some obscure rural village who may have had some run-in with the law or a fellow, you know, community member or something like that. So I do think that that's a concern. You know, we'll see.
All right. Well, Greg Sterling, I want to thank you and your daughter's parakeets for joining us today on Tech News Today.
Yes, the parakeet was very happy to be participating in the program, and I was too. Thank you.
Parakeet's ready to flip the bird to the European Union over this ruling, I guess. Okay, well, Greg Sterling could be reached at searchengineland.com and elsewhere. You can find more of his information on his Twitter account at
gsterling. You can just Google me and find me. I haven't removed any of the links yet.
Okay, well, there's a lengthy process for that, so that comes later. Thanks again, Greg.
All right, take care.
All right, in a sec, we're going to tell you about new changes coming to iPad, maybe. But first, I want to tell you about Squarespace, the number one place on the internet to create a website of any kind, including a blog, including a business site where you're selling things, including a site to raise money and to have a wedding registry, anything you want to do that involves creating a website. Why? Because Squarespace has 25 beautiful templates. When I say beautiful, I mean beautiful. These are really elegantly designed templates, but they're not set in stone. You can go in using the easy-to-use tools that Squarespace provides to customize them, add, change pages, change the configuration, the size of things, the typography. You can change everything, and it's very, very easy to do. You can also create a custom logo using Squarespace's logo creator tool, which is very cool. E-commerce is available for all subscription plan levels, so if you want to raise money or sell something, it's very easy to do. And Squarespace is inexpensive. Starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And, of course, Squarespace is famous for being mobile-ready. It looks great on a mobile device without any effort on your part, and it's also easy to manage your site using mobile devices like iPads and iPhones. So start a free 2-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT. That'll get you a discount of 10% off and also show your support for Tech News Today, and we appreciate that. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today, and remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website. Well, Apple may be planning to copy an idea from Microsoft's Surface user interface and introduce split-screen multitasking on the iPad, according to an exclusive by Mark Gurman on 9to5 Mac. Mark Gurman joins us to give us the details. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, thanks for having me. How's it going?
It's going great, thank you. How would this split-screen multitasking feature work exactly?
So if there were two apps that you wanted to use at the same time on the iPad, for example, if you wanted to use Pages, you're working on a report and you needed to look up some info online with Safari, you could open up Safari and Pages at the same time. So on one side, you would have the Safari browser. On the other side, you would have Pages, as you can see in that image on the screen right now. And you'd be able to, for example, easily copy text from the Safari side and paste it into Pages. And both applications would be usable in their normal portrait format, but they would be presented on the iPad's landscape screen. So you could have more screen space.
Now, this requires the app developers to explicitly support this multitasking feature, right?
Not exactly sure on that. What developers would have to do if they want to take full advantage of the feature is take advantage of some of the new APIs that will allow interaction between apps. It's a developer feature called XPC. Apple has been trying to get that onto iOS for the last few years, but it sounds like they've finally got the resources to launch it to the public. So that will allow content to be able to be moved from one app to another more easily.
Mark, another practical question, and this is from one of our viewers, Rodeo69 in Birmingham. He or she wants to know, would this work in portrait view?
No, the feature would be landscape only. So if the iPad is in landscape, but the app user interfaces will be their portrait orientation. So like two portrait screens on one iPad landscape.
Got it. Great.
And,
not on the iPad mini, right?
Not certain. The iPad mini is significantly smaller than the iPad Air and the iPad 4 on the 9.7-inch iPad. So it's to be seen if Apple allows it on the iPad mini.
This seems to me to be a play to increase the existing trend toward using iPads as laptops. Essentially, I do it myself. I use my iPad for all kinds of real-world work, writing columns and that sort of thing. And this would make it even better for that because, obviously if you can put two applications side by side and drag and drop content between them, you can start to do a lot more productivity hints. Do you see the iOS, this being yet another part of the trend for the iOS, to be moving toward more desktop-like and laptop-like applications?
Yeah, absolutely. This is completely a play to compete with some of the more laptop-oriented tablets like the Microsoft Surface, which has had the split-screen multitasking view for a number of years since it launched a couple of years ago. This is definitely another push towards moving into what Apple calls the post-PC world, getting rid of the laptops.
And
what's the timeline for the rollout of something like this?
For the split-screen view? So iOS 8, which is the new operating system for the iPod Touch, iPhone, and iPad, will be announced at the June Worldwide Developers Conference. And so they'll put a beta into the hands of developers, and then they'll probably release it around September, later this year.
Mark Gurman, do you think that Apple is ever going to release much larger iPads that can be used on the desktop in more, 13-inch iPads or, 15-inch iPads? Is this the future of the iPad? Is the desktop iPad in our immediate future?
Absolutely. So within 10 years or so, or even 5 years, maybe even three, they're going to need something to start replacing the Macs, because clearly the way the world is moving is to the mobile computers, not laptops, not desktops, but, full touchscreen iPads. So I think it's to be seen what's going to replace the iMac 10 years from now, what's going to replace the MacBook Pro completely 5 years from now. So I wouldn't be surprised to see 13-inch, 15-inch, 17-inch, 27-inch, 30-inch iPads, over the next couple of decades.
All right. Well, Mark Gurman, thank you for coming on and telling us about your exclusive, really great story. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
All right. You can find Mark Gurman at 9to5Mac.com and also on Twitter at Mark Gurman, Gurman spelled G-U-R-M-A-N. Well, Motorola's Moto G phone is cheap, but the company unveiled a new phone that's even cheaper, the Moto E, which costs only $129 unlocked. With us to explain and describe this phone is Ed Begg, who's a tech columnist for USA Today. Welcome, Ed.
Good to be with you.
So how do they make the Moto E so cheap? What are the specs on this thing?
Well, it's actually, on the one hand, it's got decent specs. I mean, it's certainly not a sexy phone like, the phones that we typically talk about, the Galaxies and the iPhones and things like that. But it's not a bad device. But there are trade-offs. There's no front camera, for example. The screen, while perfectly acceptable to the kind of person that I think might be attracted to a device like this, is not the kind of screen that might woo you or me.
Are they going to sell this thing in the United States and Europe, or is this something for the developing world primarily?
No, they have designs on selling it everywhere, including the U.S. One of the things they point out, the big oxymoron in the phone business is that they call the sort of very basic plain vanilla phones feature phones when they're actually light on features compared to smartphones. Mm-hmm. And Motorola is saying that nearly half the users in the U.S. are still using feature phones, and it's about 70% worldwide. So there's still a ripe market for people who presumably want to step up to the smartphone arena but don't have a lot of money to do it. Of course, there's also people who say, I want a phone that does a phone and I don't care about all this other stuff.
That's right. I mean, I'm sure not that many people there's a whole population of people who don't really need to take selfies, right? With that front, I saw the missing front camera and thought, oh no, no selfies.
No selfies, but we couldn't do what we're doing or what I'm doing now, which is talking to you guys on Skype. So, that's an area where, at least with this device, you're out of luck. But again, how many people are doing that? The people that they're really reaching to here are probably not the people who care to do that anyway.
But those people still also have to be okay with the fact that they now need a data plan versus of, you know, just a straight flip feature phone where they didn't need a data plan. Now they're paying extra a month for it. So they have to at least be okay with that extra cost.
Absolutely. You know, I don't want to minimize. And we shouldn't minimize that. You know, and my sense is, and again, I'm not the person that would be attracted to a device like this, although it seems perfectly, seems perfectly capable. But you're right. When you're looking at the low price, there's low price and there's low price. I mean, how many phones out there are free? You know, the basic flip phones and such, and even some primitive smartphones. So it'll be interesting to see how Motorola actually does with this thing.
They're clearly not targeting.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Elise.
Well, I just had a question from Stephen Kimbrough in Berkeley, California, who wants to know, are the carriers announced yet? Who's going to be carrying this phone?
According to Motorola, it's, you know, that the carriers will be carrying it. I don't have the complete list. And actually, if you probably will be able to get it as well with a contract, and then it might be free or $49 or whatever it is. I don't have the complete list, but Motorola definitely expects support from carriers for this thing.
Now, of course, Motorola taketh away and they also giveth. This phone has some interesting features that will be popular in the developing world, including a built-in FM radio, which is not something you normally find in phones. Also, dual SIM slots. That's
dual SIM, right? Yeah. Dual SIM, not dual SIM.
So
I don't know if you can see it, but this is actually the device here. I have not had a chance to actually test it, although it feels actually pretty good. And it doesn't feel like a cheap phone.
It looks like a Moto X.
It looks a lot like a Moto X, and it looks like the Moto G as well. You know, it does not have, as I think I mentioned, it doesn't have 4G LTE. And I should point out that the Moto G, which is also kind of a budget class phone, but a more expensive one, has just gotten 4G LTE, which this phone doesn't have. But again, for this market, that may not matter.
And it also has Gorilla Glass, so it's scratch resistant, which is nice. Another downside of this phone, though, is that it has only 4 gigabytes of storage, and only about 3 gigabytes of that is available to the user because the rest is used up when you're out of the box. So
that's correct. There is a slot to expand the memory if you want to go that route.
Okay, well, that's cool. Well, Ed Begg, I want to thank you for coming on Tech News today and telling us about the Moto E.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
All right. Ed Begg found at usatoday.com and also on Twitter at Ed Begg. Begg is spelled B-A-I-G. Well, a new report from Glenn Greenwald writing for The Guardian apparently reveals an NSA program that intercepts routers and server hardware being exported from the United States to buyers abroad and implants spy devices in them before sending them along to their destinations. In a related story, Greenwald's book, No Place to Hide, was published today. One gem revealed in the book is that he claims both the NSA and the UK equivalent, the GCHQ, tracked and surveilled airline passengers in real time using the in-flight internet service. Elise Hu, this is not surprising. This kind of thing is no longer surprising. We kind of expect this kind of total surveillance by the NSA and the GCHQ everywhere they can.
What still surprises me, despite the fact that we continue to see this drip, 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 is that the NSA or that we have government agency contractors that are as sophisticated as they are to do this. When I cover other government agencies, whatever it may be, there's all sorts of like basic technological capacity issues. And so every time I hear just about the sophistication of the NSA, it seems to come in contrast against every other government agency and their technical capabilities.
Two words, classified budget. They have unlimited funds because they are, it's all about national security. Now, this series of revelations, you know, as you point out, we have this conversation, and this comes up every time we talk about the NSA. All of this information comes from internal bragging, PowerPoint presentations and documents saying, oh, we could do this, we could do that. We don't know exactly how widespread this is or how hard it is. For example, this ability for them to track people in flight using the in-flight entertainment system, that's not something that just can be turned on and is routinely done for all passengers. Quite the opposite. It has to be carefully targeted towards specific passengers, and there is apparently a lot of preparation that's required in advance of the flight to make sure that they can track somebody in the flight. And it's a lot, it's pretty hazy about exactly how they track people in flight, but they do hack the phone information to determine when the person is flying, and they track them on the plane. Then they track them in the plane as they're flying across wherever they're going, and apparently harvest their data as they're using the in-flight entertainment system or internet system. So this is quite a fascinating revelation. But again, as you say, not surprising. They seem to have the key, which healthcare.gov doesn't, for example, just competent technology. Right. And also, it has to be said that this program that they have for inserting surveillance devices, little beacons and things like that, into hardware being shipped out is similar to a report that we heard a couple of months ago where they were doing this kind of installation abroad for devices that had already shipped. They had this whole process where they could have a suitcase-sized device that would use radio waves, and they could actually hack a machine that was not connected to a network, which was really impressive. So once again, the larger story here is that the NSA has proceeded in the last few years as if everything is fair game. They can surveil anything, anywhere, no matter what, and with very limited exceptions to that. And they seem to have a just colossal budget to implement this policy.
The onus, of course, is going to be on regulators in the U.S. to stop them. The sort of gestures towards that so far to end, for example, the bulk phone metadata collection actually seem as, just as I said, just as gestures compared to the kinds of things that the NSA can do and the capabilities that they have. And so there was a question about whether there are any additional moves in Washington to curtail blanket NSA surveillance. Obviously, there are some lawmakers, some chairmen like Dianne Feinstein out of California who are trying to push through. But as you know about the climate in Washington, there's very little that can get done given the politics of this year and this whole sort of era we're in.
Yeah, absolutely. And also needs to be said, one last point is that there's good spying and there's bad spying. We want spy agencies to spy on behalf of the United States. For example, we want to know certain types of information where our, you know, rivals, international rivals, whether it's North Korea or China or whoever it is, Iran, we want to have what is the opposite of ignorance. We want to have knowledge and information and intelligence about what they're doing. And so this program that we're talking about here today could be legit depending on who they're surveilling and under what circumstances. So the range here is, you know, they're tracking everybody on flights no matter what. The other part of it is they're going after drug kingpins and terrorists and dictators to specifically target certain types of information for the purpose of national security. Personally, I'm in favor of that kind of espionage. Spying is a good thing. You don't want ignorance if there's a lot of weapons and warfare and that sort of thing going on. You need intelligence. You need to know what's going on. So we don't know. This is like so many of these NSA programs. We don't know what kind of surveillance this is. This could be the good kind. It could be the bad kind. It's probably a little of both if the other revelations are any indication. So and once again, I've got, according to Amazon, I've got Greenwald's book sitting in my mailbox as we speak. So I'll be looking forward to reading what other revelations come out of it. And Glenn Greenwald, of course, is the person that Edward Snowden contacted and revealed initially all of the documents to. He was with The Guardian at the time, and now he has a new site called The Intercept, which we pretty much cover almost every story posted on The Intercept because it's such good stuff on these revelations.
So. Right, and to some extent, it's up to us, and it's up to all of us to sort of become more knowledgeable about just what is happening to our society. And so read the book if you're interested in these topics, because in a lot of ways, regulators and lawmakers, policymakers lag behind the citizenry when it comes to response. So it's up to us to be informed.
Exactly. All we need is oversight, accountability, and explicit rules that are actually followed by the intelligence community. And hopefully we can get there. Well, in just a sec, we're going to give you a follow-up on AT&T's reported desire to buy DirecTV and become a massive powerhouse in online TV and also internet connectivity. But first, I want to tell you about RingCentral. RingCentral is the cloud-based phone system that we use here at TWIT. And when we set up the TWIT brick house here, the last thing we wanted was a big, bloated, ugly PBX system that's expensive and difficult to maintain and requires an enormous amount of expertise to deal with. Instead, we went with RingCentral, which is the clear and obvious solution for having a phone system. It does all kinds of cool stuff. There's a feature called the auto receptionist, who greets our callers, announces employees and department extensions. But now there's a new feature offered by RingCentral called Meetings. And Meetings enables us to host face-to-face meetings in high definition and share desktop or document with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Meetings makes RingCentral the single best business solution on the market today. So check out RingCentral. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing, under $25 a month per user, and you can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial. And they have a special offer for our listeners. When you buy one Desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number designated for Tech News Today and TWIT listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. Well, we reported May 1st that AT&T was in talks to buy DirecTV. Those were kind of vague rumors, but now the company is getting close to finalizing the deal, according to slightly less vague rumors in the Wall Street Journal and Reuters. The proposed $50 billion merger would make AT&T the other dominant player in the pay TV and internet service market after a combined Comcast, Time Warner cable deal. And of course, Elise Hu, these are contingent on regulatory approval, which I have the sneaking suspicion is going to be granted.
Someday, I expect, and not too far from now, I expect there's only going to be one gigantic broadband company.
That's right.
I mean,
that's right.
That's the direction we're heading.
It'll cost a fortune, and it'll be like a 300 baud modem. The performance will be horrible, and it will be owned by the president. It's a bleak future, and I really hate to see the Comcasts and the AT&Ts of the world essentially taking over and being in the driver's seat in terms of how content is delivered. I felt for a while, I was pretty optimistic that we were moving toward this future where you could watch anything on TV or get anything via the internet that you wanted at any time. But it looks like we could be taking a left turn here toward a world where these companies like AT&T and Comcast have a stranglehold over what we can get, and they have all the bargaining power when it comes to negotiating content deals with the content providers, with Hollywood, and also with, you know, the Apples and the Googles of the world. So it's
right. And speaking of that, of course, we're expecting the revised proposal from FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler on net neutrality after pretty boisterous public outcry to his original proposal, which basically signaled that he would be cool with fast lanes and slow lanes that these broadband companies could pay for. And so we are expecting those, that proposed draft and the revisions to that sometime this week.
Yeah, Thursday is the vote. And, you know, it's kind of funny because this is semi-secret. Personally, I have not seen either the original proposal, nor have I seen the draft. I just heard it described by journalists. And so we don't know exactly what he proposed. We don't know what the revised version is. But I don't like the sound of it from what I've read. It sounds like in both cases, it's being set up in a way that sounds like it's tough on that it supports net neutrality, but requires a constant vigilance by the FCC to enforce it. And you can essentially remove net neutrality in the future by simply backing off on enforcement. And that's the wrong way to go. It has to be set more in stone than that, in my opinion.
Obviously would have huge implications, though, for companies like AT&T, Comcast, and Time Warner, who have all written an open letter just this morning saying, please back off. We don't want more teeth.
Exactly. Well, that's why they put their lobbyist in charge of the FCC. If I sound cynical, I apologize, but that's what's happening here. We have a lobbyist running the FCC again. Well, in other news, Google Glass might be getting a keyboard. No, it's not a physical keyboard you wear on your face, but a virtual one. A Canadian company called Worldscape unveiled today a glassware implementation demo of their Minuum keyboard. The technology groups letters together in your field of view, so instead of selecting individual letters, you tilt your head to navigate to the group of letters that contains the specific letter you want to type.
Oh.
Then you tap the glass touchpad to select. Yeah, exactly.
No.
Minuum uses predictive algorithms to figure out the words. So in addition to looking like a glass hole dork wearing Google Glass in public, you're also staring wildly into space, tilting your head manically and poking at your temple like a crazy person. Welcome, Jason, to the future.
I mean, I suppose you got to give it to him for trying, right? And that's kind of what the whole glass experiment has been about for the past year. It's not a consumer product. It's been all about, here's interesting new hardware. Developers, figure out what you can do with it. What are the, you know, different ways that you can approach and tackle both the capabilities and the downsides to this hardware? And you had to imagine that somebody was going to say, no, voice input is unpredictable at times, so let's make a keyboard that mimics what people are used to using in the hardware sense. But at the same time, it just seems like an unnecessary step backwards. Who knows? Maybe it's more usable than it looks like in the video, but I would not, at first glance, that looks like a nightmare to me.
Elise Hu, Jason and I are glass holes. How about you?
I am not. I can't even really, I'm not coordinated enough to even get through the main menu. I can't even imagine trying to type on this. The coordination required and just like the sort of motions, I guess, of your head that have to work, have to be sort of perfectly calibrated seem to scare me.
Yeah.
I'm not anti-glass. I'm just not a user.
It's kind of scary.
I've tested it out.
Oh, okay. It's kind of scary to use the voice activation because essentially once you initiate the process of posting or sending a message using voice, it's going to go unless you stop it. So the default mode is it just, you can see it in the screen. The countdown is like, okay, this is going to go in 3, 2, 1, boom, it's gone. And so if there's a mistake in there, you have to really be on the ball to stop it from going out. I could actually see a keyboard implementation via Bluetooth for Google Glass that might be kind of cool. For example, I can imagine sitting at a desk wearing Google Glass, have a message come in, and then just go to reply and then hit a button on my keyboard and have the keyboard go from controlling my iPad or something to controlling glass, type a message that I can see in the glass screen and then send it off. That might be cool. This product, I don't see happening. It's just too much. There's too much head tilting and, you know, predictive. It's just so counterintuitive and counter to the purpose of glass in the first place, which is a natural interface where you can just talk and send messages by just talking.
And so since you're playing the role of the cynic, I will play the role of the optimist to say that there's plenty of times where technology has actually been a driver for behavioral change. So it is possible, though probably not plausible, that our behaviors could change to adapt to the way glass has you type.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Elise Hu, that's the tech news today. I want to thank you for being our guest co-anchor today.
It was so much fun. Thanks, Mike.
All right. And you can find Elise Hu at NPR, of course, all over NPR, and also on Twitter at Elise Hu. Her last name is spelled H-U, but on Twitter it's spelled W-H-O, because that's hilarious. And thanks.
It's my dad joke.
Yeah, it's good. I like it. Thank you very much again for being on Tech News Today.
Thanks, guys.
All right. You can subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT, and we recommend that you do so. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Tech News Today. And you can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. We also want to hear from you. Comment on Twitter or Google Plus using the hashtag Tech News Today, and we'll find it. And you can also send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight. Here on the TWIT Network. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.